Hello and welcome once again to the St Albans and District Talking Newspaper, serving St Albans, Harpenden and the surrounding areas. This is the primary edition for the week ending Saturday the 7th of May 2022. My name is Ian, I edit and produce this programme. This edition of Primary will once again be distributed on USB sticks. Please remember to return them in the wallet provided when you have finished listening. Additionally, the programme is available on our website, sadtn.org.uk, under Listen Online. If you are using a mobile device, then it's available via the British Wireless for the Blind Fund app. This can be downloaded via iTunes or Google Play. Search for Talking Newspaper. Amongst other items, this edition has, as usual on the USB stick distribution only, the BBC In Touch podcast. We'll also have the usual news roundup and the national radio listings read by John Cushing. And once again, we'll be delving into the Vocalise London Beyond Sight archives with the description of that great British icon, the Pillar Box. I will also feature another American Vocalise piece, this time a description of the 9/11 memorial on Staten Island. There will also be the list of audio described programmes on TV, and also an episode of In Concert. To finish, I'll be looking at past events and birthdays in the week. This week's music is Piano Swing Blues by Goffby. Now, as this programme is recorded on Thursday, 2 days ago, the polling stations for the local elections are still open, so sadly there will be no news of the results. So let's move on to other news, read by Jane, Christine, David, Jessica, Andy, Deborah and Keith.
This is Keith McDougall. Sustainability Festival returns in style for 2022. The St Albans Sustainability Festival has launched its programme of more than 80 events taking place across the district over the last 2 weeks of May. The Chair and Trustee of Sustainable St Albans, Jill Watson, said, "We're delighted to bring such a rich variety of fantastic events together. We'd like to thank all the organisations, faith groups, schools and businesses who are organising activities, talks, films, open days and much more over the 2 weeks. We're also extremely grateful to our crowdfunder contributors who've been showing us how important the climate crisis is to residents. The SustFest's launch event on Sunday, May the 15th, will be the Sustainability Market on Harpenden Common, organised by Sustainable St Albans and Harpenden Town Council. The trustee of Sustainable St Albans, Leslie Flowers, said, "The SustFest 22 Harpenden Sustainability Market is sure to be a fun day out for all the family, with live music and performances, delicious vegan street food and a wide variety of eco stalls, run by great local sustainable businesses, charities and community groups. The launch market will be followed by 2 weeks of events, most of them free. Some need booking in advance, including a talk on sustainable food by local foodie Becky Alexander. The opportunity to meet rescued hedgehogs with the Hearts and Middlesex Wildlife Trust, two repair fairs and a Change the World Through Music live concert. A repair fair gives people the chance to have their broken items fixed, including electronics. Other SustFest 22 events are drop-in. The first few days will see Sopwell Community Gardens Open Day, a craft swish, talks at the Rothamsted Research Centre and free Woodcroft folk sessions for children. Farhat Zia of the Hearts Asian Women's Association, HAWA, said, "We look forward to welcoming visitors to the CDA Hearts Community Garden in Hicksbury Lane, St Albans, on Thursday, May the 19th, from 10:30 a.m. until 2 p.m, where there'll be talks and activities. HAWA Habiba Garden will be sharing the health benefits of Asian herbs at 12 noon. Just come along. Access the full 2022 Sustainability Festival programme and find the festival's crowdfunder link at www.sustfest.org. That's www.sustfest.org.
Hello, my name's Deborah. And my first piece is headed SOSFest Business Panel. The challenges and highlights of striving to achieve sustainability in business will be the theme of a special panel event in St Albans later this month. Popular restaurant chain Lussmann's will be hosting the session at their St Albans venue at 9:30 a.m. on May the 22nd, as part of this year's St Albans Sustainability Festival. Panelists will include Ruby Rout, founder of WUKA, W-U-K-A, the UK's first period pants brand, Stuart Roberts from Hammond's End Farm in Harpenden, former deputy president of the National Farmers Union, and André Lussmann himself. They will discuss the challenges and highlights of striving to achieve sustainability in business. The talk will be moderated by Helen Burridge, founder of Place Positive and Sustainable Business Collaborator, and will raise money for the Bear Trust to help victims of the war in Ukraine. André Lussmann said, "I'm delighted to be running this event as part of the St Albans Sustainability Festival, and that Ruby, Stuart and Helen are joining me to discuss the really important subject of sustainability in business. I am also hoping to announce other panellists soon. I have built my restaurant brand on the principles of sustainability, and it's great for businesses to share their learning and practices on this issue. This is an opportunity for local people to come together and talk about sustainability while fundraising for a great cause. It is also a chance for younger people in the community, in particular students of geography, environmental studies, business studies, and other relevant subjects, to expand their knowledge about sustainability in practice across a range of sectors and ask questions directly to some fascinating panellists. The event will include a light breakfast with tea and coffee, and tickets will cost £15 and can be purchased on the Lussmann's website, www.lussmanns.com.
Hello, I'm Andy. This article is headed Murder City, Crime Novels Set in St Albans. Forget Grantchester and Midsummer. The new murder capital of England could very well end up being St Albans. That is, if up-and-coming author Rachel Block has anything to say about it, after setting her fourth crime novel in the heart of the Cathedral City. She's bumped people off near Verulamium Lake and in the Old Roman Theatre, and has now left a suspicious corpse at the base of the Abbey's 50-foot tower. But did he jump, or was he pushed? Enter Dutch-born Detective Chief Inspector Martin Janssen, based out of the city centre's now-demolished police station. An outsider who pierces the affluent veneer of St Albans during the course of her investigations. You know what St Albans is like. It's all super polite and very, very lovely. I needed someone who cuts through all of that, she explained. Apart from the cathedral, The Fall also focuses on local mental health hospitals, Sell Barnes and Hill End, combined in the novel as a solitary Hill Barnes, looking at how the treatment of women with psychiatric problems has changed over the last century. Rachel said, "One of the most distressing aspects of researching the novel was reading many diary entries of patients of mental health hospitals over the last century. There are so many stories of feeling misunderstood, of manifestations of grief causing people to be admitted." Rachel is unique in setting her novels in the city, although she is careful to avoid upsetting locals. "It's broader brushstrokes because I don't want to be sued. I do know which cafe I'm referring to at times, but I never name them, although readers always ask. I did the Waffle House in the first one, but called it something else, and put the old wheel outside. I was talking to them about it, and they asked why I didn't call it the correct name. Well, it's like my version of St Albans. It's been made to fit a commercial novel. It has to be tight and fit the plot." So what's next for Rachel? There's so much here, there's so much history, so many possibilities. And perhaps an appearance by the Hearts Ad in a future novel? I could easily put that in, she promised. Rachel will be attending an event at Books on the Hill on May the 10th at 7 p.m. And there's a photograph of Rachel, and underneath says, Rachel Bloch says of her protagonist, I liked the idea of a matter-of-fact Dutch outsider cutting through the St. Albans niceties.
Hello, I'm Jessica, and here is a story from the Rene Grove Hospice Care Charity. Hospice tackles stigma with Dying Matters Week. Rene Grove is joining Hospice UK's annual awareness week to get people talking about death and dying. Dying Matters Awareness Week 2022 runs from May the 2nd to the 6th and will focus on what it means to be in a good place when you die. As part of this year's campaign, Rene Grove will be suggesting a conversation topic for each day of the week on its social platforms. Clinical Content Manager Christina Jones explains, each topic is designed to encourage people to start thinking and talking about dying, and each conversation starter goes to the heart of the work we do with families affected by life-limiting illness. We want everyone to be in a good place when they die, whatever that means for them. Rene Grove will be asking its followers questions such as whether they've made a will or discussed their wishes around organ donation with their family and recorded them on the NHS Organ Donation Register, or considered their digital legacy and to whom they might entrust their passwords. They'll also invite people to join the discussion about how they'd choose to spend their final days. By talking about sharing, we can remove the taboo and stigma that surrounds death and dying, says Christina. After all, it's the one certainty we all face in life, and we know from experience that planning for it as much as we can makes such a difference. To help people get thinking, talking and planning, Rene Grove will also be promoting Hospice UK's Planning Ahead tool during the Awareness Week. The online tool takes you through all the important considerations about end-of-life care wishes and gives you an opportunity to document your preferred options as you go, adds Christina. She says that by joining in with these difficult conversations now, you'll be helping other families and future generations too. We know that, very sadly, people are dying without the support they need. By talking and sharing, we can better understand what's happening in our communities and tell political and healthcare leaders what's needed to make high-quality end-of-life care accessible to everyone. Follow Rene Grove on social media to join the conversation about why dying matters.
Hello, this is Jane Wilson. And first, a personal view from local MP Daisy Cooper. Please vote in your local elections this week. No matter who is in power, a democracy can only function well when that power is limited by checks and balances, and when access to democracy is as wide as possible. All of this came into question last week as the government pushed through its elections bill. It's long been said that absolute power corrupts absolutely, and the idea of dividing or separating political powers has been key to British values for hundreds of years now. But that British tradition was under threat this week. The government's initial version of the Elections Bill tried to claim powers for ministers so that they could effectively ban campaigners they don't like during elections. Further, despite minuscule evidence of voter fraud, the government wanted to make compulsory ID requirements for future elections that would have disenfranchised millions who don't have a passport or driver's licence. Thankfully, because of the scrutinising powers of both the opposition parties in the Commons and the House of Lords, we were all able to demand concessions from the government. Now, for example, the compulsory voter ID will include documents such as bank statements, council tax demands and library cards, ID that almost everyone has. Still, as it came to pass, the Elections Bill means that the government will control more powers over elections and will now be able to direct the Electoral Commission's priorities as well as controlling the parliamentary committee that scrutinises it. As others have pointed out, this is like putting a fox in control of the henhouse. This government seems determined to keep rewriting the rulebook in order to prop itself up. If it was convinced it could win on its own merits, this undemocratic bill simply wouldn't be needed. By the end of the week, the parliamentary session had ended. Parliament won't sit again until the next Queen's speech on May the 10th, when the government will set out a new list of legislation it wants to push through. During this time, the local elections are taking place. Some people will vote based on local issues, others on national issues. Whatever your motivation or party preferences, please do go and use your vote.
Hello, I'm Christine Stanley, and my first item is about golf balls. Thousands of surplus golf balls have been donated by Wheathampstead Club members for recycling in order to help Ukraine refugees. Mid-Hearts Golf Club, based in Lower Gusted Wood, Lamer Lane, has been running the initiative over the past few months with the aim of boosting funds for humanitarian relief efforts. It was devised by Terry Holden, who said, initially, one 45-gallon drum was cut in half to form two troughs into which golf balls could be loaded, placed outside the hub, and a Ukrainian flag hung behind them. Soon afterwards, balls started arriving by the bucket loads, and it became obvious that further barrels and containers would be required. We've been overwhelmed with the thousands of surplus golf balls donated by our members. The club will be sending all cash donations to the Diocese of St. Albans Charitable Fund for housing refugees from Ukraine, and any surplus will be forwarded to the Disaster Emergency Committee. And there's a photograph of four half barrels painted blue with the Ukrainian flag behind them, absolutely chock-a-block full of golf balls.
Now, from the letters page, NHS Trust is living in a parallel universe, by Linda Leonard. Helen Brown wrote that the West Hearts NHS Trust's online session on the 6th of May is for anyone who would like to understand more about the discussions and decisions related to the redevelopment plans. Chance would be a fine thing. According to the Trust's website, the session will be even more restricted as the update will discuss engagement opportunities for the board meeting on May the 31st, where the board will approve its preferred option. So much for the fresh eyes approach, as Philip Eilert's letter makes abundantly clear in the same edition of your newspaper. Actually, I and others would dearly like more public light shone upon Trust decision-making process. What is especially worrying is that far from being open to the other site options, the Trust tied itself to redeveloping Watford General years ago by aligning itself with Watford Council's regeneration plans. A central part of these plans involves retaining and redeveloping Watford General Hospital. Watford Council's actions are completely understandable. The Trust's actions, not so much. It should be entirely devoted to health care and patient welfare across the area it covers. Surely it has no business getting involved in the development plans of one borough council and specific private sector developers. For instance, perhaps the Trust could explain why it has a link to marketing material about Watford Riverwell on its website, astonishingly in the section that is entitled About the Trust. Follow the link and it takes you to a website where you can make inquiries about buying a new house. Uncomfortable questions arise about this. Why does the Trust appear to be endorsing this one among a number of housing offers in the area? Can other estate agents advertise on the site? And what are the rates? Is the advertising there because of a commercial arrangement? And what money, if any, has changed hands in the process? Where is this in the remit of an NHS hospital trust, and one, it bears repeating, that is supposed to be looking after the health interests of everyone in all parts of West Hearts? And so this is the unedifying background to the Trust's decision to cling to its plan to redevelop Watford Hospital at the expense of the interests of present and future generations of people across West Hearts. In order to try to justify this untenable position, the board members and senior management appear to have created a parallel universe, one where it's a good idea to plan new acute care hospital facilities on a site surrounded by concrete blocks with more developments planned. where a major rebuild at an existing hospital will somehow have few or no detrimental effects on the care of the patients and on staff, despite the inevitable disruptions for years to inpatient care, outpatient appointments, the noise, the dust, contractor traffic, etc. For the umpteenth time, why would you plan new hospital development on a site that is impossible or very difficult to get to for so many across West Harts because of the distances and poor public transport? Not to mention the regular traffic jams that get even worse on match days, as the hospital is so conveniently situated for ambulances and patients right next to a Premier League football club. The Trust's parallel universe also includes the notion that getting funding for a capital spend of at least £1.1 billion is a viable proposition. This is cloud cuckoo land when placed against the size of the limited government budget for the whole of the new hospital programme. Equally important is the question of financial prudence. Government funding under the new hospital programme is based not on grants, but consists of loans that have to be repaid. Placing a debt of over £1 billion on the Trust's finances is highly dubious, to say the least, not to mention the associated maintenance costs that will be involved. As Philip Islett wrote, the Trust needs to fulfil its promise to make a fresh and thorough assessment of the option of building on a clear and more central site. For the sake of the people it is meant to be working for across West Harts, it must dispense with its cosy parallel universe and get real.
Pub Pride returns to St Albans for a second year of celebrations. A celebration of Pride across St Albans pubs is set to return for its second year. Launched in 2021, the fundraising event was established by Danny Clare, founder of Ask for Clive charity, and this year takes place on May the 27th. It was put together to allow pubs to welcome the LGBTQ+ community and highlight their commitment to diversity, as well as engaging with young people who might not previously have taken part in Pride events. The day will see a whole host of activities and events for the whole community and visitors to engage with in our city. This year, Pub Pride beers will be available from Far Brew and Mad Squirrel, and St Albans Cathedral and Museum and Gallery will both be illuminated in Pride colours. Harts Gay Outdoor Group has arranged a walk to the Elephant and Castle in Wheathamstead, and there are plans for a drag dinner to be held at Dillon's in George Street. St Albans pubs will be dressed in Pub Pride bunting and flags, and will also welcome drag artist Vicky Vivacious, who is the Ask for Clive ambassador. There'll be an afternoon Pride service at St Saviour's Church in Sandpit Lane, as well as a comedy event at the White Lion. Staggered start times will ensure people can take part in a number of activities throughout the day and evening. Danny said, "We are once again thrilled with the support of St Albans Pubs and Hospitality to Pub Pride 2022 and the Ask for Clive campaign. Nationally, we have some wonderful new partners and iconic LGBTQ+ venues taking part, but our home city will once again be blazing a trail. It's humbling to see the commitment local business makes to diversity and inclusion. We look forward to the local LGBTQ+ community, their family, friends and allies have a wonderful Pub Pride 2022 on Friday, May the 27th. Ask for Clive was founded in St Albans in 2019 to create welcome spaces and work with venues to combat discrimination. Venues are still being invited to sign up for the event.
The headline for this article is Rescue Drama, Indiana Channing and the Raiders of the Lost Cat. She may share her name with one of cinema's most celebrated adventurers, archaeologist Dr. Jones, but Indiana, the cat, bit off more than she could chew when she ended up stranded up a conifer tree. Half Maine Coon, half miscellaneous, is how owner Jonathan Channing describes the free-spirited feline who went missing from the family home in Chiswell Green on Wednesday evening. After being absent for 24 hours, which he said was most out of character, and when the usual alerts on Chiswell Green WhatsApp groups had come to nothing, Indiana's whereabouts remained a mystery. Then, At around 9 p.m. on Thursday night, they heard a meowing. Jonathan explained, "We followed our ears and tracked the noise to two gardens down, one across. She was stuck up the top of a conifer. We could see the reflection of her eyes with a torch, but after an hour of coaxing her down to no avail, we called in a night and promised her to call out the fire brigade, RSPCA or a tree surgeon in the morning. High Elms tree surgeries Reese rescued her this morning. And fast too. Amazing service. They responded to a WhatsApp within 1 minute at 7 a.m. and were on site at 8:30 to bring her down. Indy was occupying a magpie nest and may have fed on the eggs to sustain her for about 35 hours stuck up there." A spokesperson for High Elms said, "As a professional tree surgery business that's been operating in the area for over 30 years, the team at High Elms Tree Surgery Limited are also great animal lovers. Rescuing cats is in our skill set, alongside a wide range of tree surgery. We get several calls a year from worried pet owners and are always happy to assist to ensure a happy and safe solution for pet and their owner. Reese is an exceptional employee who regularly receives fabulous feedback from our customers." And there's a photograph of Reese in his tree climbing gear, ropes and bits and pieces, holding in his arms the cat, Indiana. And, well, Reese has a big smile on his face and the cat's not looking so sure.
Supercar stopped. A stunned supercar driver was forced to peel off his illegal window tints after being reported for a string of motoring offences in St Albans. The driver of the flashy white Audi R8 was stopped at the BP garage on Watling Street, just off the A414 North Orbital Road, on Monday. Police said it was a lovely car, but was a tad illegal for road use. A spokesperson for Hertfordshire Police said, "This R8 attracted our attention. No front plate, illegal rear plate, side tints at 18% and windscreen at 30% light transmission. The minimum limits are 70% and 75% respectively. Driver reported for offences and tints removed at scene. It's a lovely car, just a tad illegal for road use. Undeclared modifications can render some policies invalid if not declared to the insurer, be they legal or otherwise. If the modifications are discovered after a crash, then this could affect cover and subsequent recompense. Always best to check."
From the letters page, a letter on littering problems from Leslie Freitag. "We had an election circular from the Conservatives featuring litter as a problem locally. A particular issue, along with leaves in gutters and grubby pavements, except, of course, near the Civic Centre. Spotless. Well done, I thought, to the Conservatives for highlighting it. Then a leading Sunday paper featured a picture of none other than Sir Ed Davey, leader of the Lib Dems, doing a litter pick in Solihull, West Midlands. Must be a problem there too. I can still recall Mrs Thatcher doing a similar one-off litter pick in a London park back in the 1980s. The problem is nationwide and never-ending. Harpenden Town Council knows of dozens of groups that do their own thing regularly too. The current excuse for non-cleaning is said to be COVID, but stations and trains are spotlessly clean, and the reason is COVID. This sadly doesn't apply to bus shelters, which remain neglected pre- and post-COVID. Maybe bus users catching COVID is okay. The election leaflet, by the way, says, we pay enough for cleaning. Perhaps yes, or no. The examples above don't prove the case either way. They do prove there is a constant and unresolved problem. Maybe we could take a leaf out of a book of the good old US of A. In some states like Michigan, local community groups are paid to pick the interstate verges at weekends. Are we at that stage here too?"
And now from the letters page, here's a letter headed "Respect My Sex Campaign Coverage." "Thank you for the excellent coverage of the Respect My Sex campaign in St Albans last week. We were interested to read MP Daisy Cooper's response to the campaign. Daisy claimed that more advice needs to be provided to service providers for how to make decisions on single-sex exceptions. The Equality and Human Rights Commission, the EHRC, provided such guidance in April this year, giving clear real-life examples of when and how service providers could apply single-sex exceptions. It's worrying that a Member of Parliament is not aware of this guidance. We are also unsure what Daisy means by safeguards to prevent abuse. What safeguards is she referring to? At present, society has moved towards allowing people to self-identify their gender in many situations, including rape counselling services and hospital wards. NHS Guidance, Annex B, allows males who identify as women and non-binary individuals to choose which single-sex hospital ward they're treated on. This has been abused on a number of occasions, including one case of a woman who was raped while in hospital and told for a whole year that this was impossible as there were no males on the ward. Lying to patients who raise concerns about trans patients on single-sex wards is enshrined in Annex B. We would therefore like Daisy to clarify what safeguards she thinks are in place. The Liberal Democrat position is to allow people to self-identify their gender at will and to remove single-sex exceptions as per their Transgender Health and Intersex Charter, passed at conference in 2015. This policy has so far not been changed, so we assume that is still the Liberal Democrats' and Daisy's position. And that letter is from the Women's Rights Network, Hertfordshire and Cambridge.
Hello, David Ireson here, with some items from this week's Hearts Advertiser from the Leisure page. The first one entitled Abbey Theatre. A Bunch of Amateurs is the company of Ten's next production at the Abbey Theatre in St Albans. When a Suffolk amateur dramatic company, the Stratford Players, wants to save their theatre, they invite Hollywood actor Jefferson Steele to play King Lear. It's a marriage made in hell. Steele thinks he's going to Stratford-upon-Avon, and the locals have entirely overestimated Steele's suitability for a Shakespearean role. The script by comedy writing duo Ian Hislop and Nick Newman will have you laughing in the aisles at the quickfire dialogue and delicious one-liners. Despite the title of the upcoming play, The Company of Ten is in fact run to professional standards, showcasing outstanding quality theatre to the local community. Performances take place from Friday, May the 13th to Saturday, May the 21st at 8 o'clock, with a Sunday matinee on May the 15th at 2:30. For tickets, visit www.abbeytheatre.org.uk or call the box office on 01727 857 861. The Hertfordshire ME / CFS support group is staging an exhibition of members' creative work to support MEA's actions # Millions Missing campaign and to raise awareness of the group. The art exhibition will be hosted at Collective Gallery and Art Project Space in Holywell Hill, St Albans, from Thursday, May the 12th to May the 24th. Maxine Ellis, the founder of the Hearts Group, who suffers from ME, said, "Living with these conditions can be very isolating. The exhibition and campaign are important to us because it highlights those missing from society due to the impact of the symptoms of ME, CFS, PVFS and fibromyalgia. By exhibiting our members' creative work, we can celebrate what achievements they have created and they become visible in the community." Annie Brewster, Vice Chairman of the Hearts County Council, is a supporter of the group and is due to officially open the exhibition on May the 12th. ME/CFS Awareness Day. The Hearts ME/CFS support group has over 230 members. The debut novel of St Albans writer Stephen Mitchell is published next week. Under the Moss, a highly readable and unique novel with a mystery at its core, is published by award-winning Hearts-based SRL Publishing and will be available from all good bookshops from May the 10th. Stephen, who grew up in Peterborough and has lived in St Albans since 2014, is keen to point out that his novel is not actually about moss. Every writer has experienced this. After you've let it slip that you're writing a novel, a family member, friend or colleague will ask, "What's it about?" Some writers are gifted with an ability to instantly summarise their book, but I'm not one of those. Instead, I tend to mumble something about a woman who likes moss. In reality, it's more complex than that, but I've never explained it well. And soon, word spread that I was writing not a novel, but a non-fiction book about moss. He added, "My book is not about moss. If you want to read a book that's not about moss, then my novel is for you." A talented guitarist will play the free lunchtime concert at St Peter's for the first time next week. Michael Pohl is due to perform at the St Albans City Centre Church on Wednesday, May the 11th, with donations in aid of Rennie Grove Hospice Care. The guitar recital will feature works by J.S. Bach, arranged for seven-string guitar by conductor, guitarist and producer Michael Pohl. Michael studied at the University of Pennsylvania before pursuing postgraduate studies at the Poznan Academy of Music, Poland, and the Guildhall School of Music and Drama in London. He is a previous Marshall Scholar, 2012-2015, and Fulbright Scholar, 2010-11. Michael's debut guitar album, Seven String Bach, featuring his own transcriptions of Bach's lute suites, was acclaimed as masterful by Gramophone. Since its release in 2018, the album has been streamed over 1 million times and has been featured on BBC Radio 3, Classic FM and Scala Radio. Wednesday lunchtime recitals start at 1 o'clock.
And now a list of deaths as published in this week's Hertfordshire Advertiser. Eileen Holt, 92. Lillian O'Grady. Jean Mary Garner, 94. David Carter, 73. Walter Charles Gray, 96. Mary Elizabeth Farmer, 85. Dr. Michael Stuart Musgrave, 71. Ivor Jones. William Joseph Sullivan, 88. A little more music from Goffby now, followed by John Cushing reading the national radio listings.
Now for a look at some of this coming week's radio highlights, starting on Saturday, May 7th. Two dramas on Saturday afternoon on Radio 4. At 3 o'clock, Pride and Protest tells of a disability rights activist recalling her glory days. And on Radio 4 Extra, a classic play from 1905, Granville Barker's The Voicey Inheritance. Opera on 3 at 6:30pm on Saturday is Puccini's Turandot from the New York Met. And an evening of comedy is promised on Radio 4 Extra from 7 when I Did It My Way, Andy Hamilton talks about his radio career, featuring complete episodes of Old Hattie's Game, amongst others. There's some contrasting choices at 9pm on Saturday. Either David Meller's Melodies on Classic FM, Episode 6 of G.F. Newman's The Corrupted on Radio 4, or what about Radio 2, Made in Italy, which looks at Italy's influence on pop music from the 60s to today. Of course, Italy winning the Eurovision Song Contest last year. And to mark the 100th anniversary of the publication of Richmel Crompton's Just William stories, Vedmar Rowett considers how and why the stories continue to delight. On to Sunday, May 8th, and the latest castaway on Desert Island Discs, is former US National Security Council advisor Fiona Hill, who testified against her boss, Donald Trump. Part 2 of the crime thriller Foreign Bodies, Grain of Truth is at 3 o'clock on Radio 4 on Sunday. John Humphreys hosts 3 hours of classical music from 4 on Classic FM. Sunday night is Music Night, of course, on Radio 2 at 7, and includes popular works from ballet and musical theatre. And Drama on 3 at 7:30pm is an original drama, Elizabeth and Essex, based on the writings of Lytton Strachey. On to programmes then that are serialised. Weekdays, same time, same radio station, every day. Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. So, same time, same radio station, each day. Book of the Week, Good Pop, Bad Pop. Jarvis Cocker reads from his coming-of-age memoir at 9:45am on Radio 4. Nagamon Chetty at 11am on Radio 5 Live from Monday to Wednesday, and Adrian Childs Thursday and Friday has the latest news interviews and listeners' questions. Composer of the Week on Radio 3 is Ralph Vaughan Williams, continuing a month-long showcase of his works, and that's on at noon all week, Monday to Friday. A continuation of What Really Happened in the 80s is at 1:45 on Radio 4 in the afternoon. And from Tuesday to Friday, there's a dramatisation of Jack London's seafaring tale, The Sea Wolf. That's at 3 o'clock on Radio 4 Extra. All week, the Classic FM concert with John Suchet at 8pm. While on Radio 4 Extra, there are two thrillers. The first is at 8 o'clock, Unnatural Death by Dorothy L. Sayers. And it's followed at 8:30 by the political thriller The House. And Book of Bedtime rounds it all off, 10:45 each night on Radio 4. It's the continuation this week of Bridget Jones's Diary. To the rest of the highlights then, with Monday, May 9th, 11:30am Radio 4. Don't log off. Alan Dean connects with ordinary people throughout the world. This week he connects with Uganda, Kenya and Zambia. Topical drama by Mark Lawson at 2:15 on Radio 4 with the ambiguous title Politics, Philosophy and Economics, commonly referred as PPE, tells of a company manufacturing patriotic souvenirs being recruited to make PPE for the government. You can follow that with the brain-teasing Round Britain quiz at 3 o'clock on Radio 4. Or on Radio 4 Extra at 3, Viva la République is set during the 1968 Paris uprising when de Gaulle fled the Élysée Palace and disappeared for 6 hours. Back to Radio 4 at 4, Writing the Road to War. Broadcaster Horatio Clare travels from Dorset to Ukraine to deliver aid, tracking his prose journey with the writings of Orwell, Matthew Arnold and others. Radio 3 in concert at 7pm includes works by Mozart, Sibelius and Beethoven. And The Blue Show with Keris Matthews is at 9 o'clock on Radio 2. Tuesday, May 10th sees the continuation of the horribly fascinating Putin at 11am on Radio 4. This penultimate episode discusses his persecution of Alexei Navalny, whose collection of expensive watches and his palaces. Final story in the long-running drama Brief Lives is at 2:15 on Radio 4, with the concluding part on Wednesday. Michael Rosen hosts another episode of Word of Mouth. This week is called What is Language For? And if you missed the first episode last week of Just William Live, it's repeated at 5:30pm on Radio 4 Extra on Tuesday, while the second part is at 6:30 on Radio 4. Martin Jarvis, of course, reads Just William. And that is, like Martin Jarvis's voice, irresistible. Concert on Radio 3 at 7:30 includes Prokofiev's Piano Concerto No. 2. In Touch at 8:40 on Radio 4, as always for a Tuesday evening. Well, at 9pm, your choice is either the Jazz Show with Jamie Cullum on Radio 2, or what about the Radio 4 Extra Powers of Persuasion, How Britain Learned to Sell, with Charts 100 Years of British Advertising. Wednesday, May the 11th, we go cuckoo at 11 a.m. when Radio 4 takes us to Cuckoo Land in Time Flies. A Cheshire couple have a collection of 400 cuckoo clocks, the world's largest, and are worried about the fate of the collection when they can no longer take care of them. There's an hour of comedy on Radio 4 Extra at 6:30 p.m, a profile of the comedian Ted Ray, and at 7 p.m, Hancock's Half Hour. And The Folk Show with Mark Radcliffe, 9 o'clock on Radio 2, rounds off Wednesday. Thursday, May 12th, and another of Radio 4's wonderfully quirky programmes at 11:30 a.m, A Life in Miniature tells of novelist Max Porter's love affair with model villagers. The drama Our Friends in the North continues at 2:15 on Radio 4, followed at 3 by Claire Baldwin's Ramblings, taking us for a walk following a section of the Southwest Coastal Path. Paul Sinner's Perfect Pub Quiz can be joined at 6:30 on Radio 4. While on Radio 2, to round off Thursday, The Country Show with Bob Harris at 9 p.m. And Friday, May 13th, unlucky for some, but not for us, because we see the welcome return of Richard Wilson's very nearly true life story, Believe It. You can join him and his friend David Tennant at 11:30 a.m. on Radio 4. If you sometimes look back fondly on the 1970s, then join Michael Bubbins' Retrosexual at 5:30 p.m. on Radio 4 Extra. Not feeling at home in the present age, he lives his life as if in the 70s, and even drives a Ford Cortina. For a satirical look at the week's news, join Mark Steele and Angela Barnes for the news quiz at 6:30 on Radio 4. Sounds of the 80s with Gary Davis and Simon Le Bon at 8 p.m. on Radio 2. Well, if you'd like to catch up with this week's episodes of What Really Happened in the 90s, there's an omnibus edition at 9 p.m. on Radio 4. That's it for another week. May I wish you a peaceful, safe and enjoyable one of radio listening.
Thanks very much, John. Now, another from our series, London Beyond Sight. This is one of the many items that can be found on the Vocalise website. This time, actor Tony Robinson describes the pillar box.
My name's Tony Robinson. I played Baldric in Blackadder, and for the last 20 years or so I've been presenting the archaeology programme Time Team on Channel 4, and so my life has revolved around cathedrals and castles, not to mention airports and suspension bridges, to 20 million people, and yet somehow we all manage to function together. And that's partly because of the architecture that we use to organise the way we live. Things that we've almost stop noticing, things like zebra crossings that are exquisitely designed for their function. And I've chosen as my London landmark something I think is the epitome of those iconic pieces, the pillar box on the corner of Formosa Street and Warrington Crescent, here right near my home, which is about 100 yards away in Maida Vale. This pillar box marks the area where I live, rather like a stone marks a parish boundary. Whenever I'm coming home from a trip, I'm greeted by this explosion of redness. I can't think of anything else of this type that's got its own utterly designated colour. And pillar box red is such a bright, vibrant red that it's utterly distinctive. Before 1859, there wasn't a standard colour, but then a browny green was brought in. It was intended to be in sympathy with the surroundings, but it was so inconspicuous that people kept bumping into the boxes. The pillar box red we now have became the standard colour in 1874. My pillar box right here is one of the George V versions. He reigned from 1910 to 1936, so it's at least 76 years old, and it's likely to be much older. It's a cylindrical shape, about 5'4" high, just a little bit shorter than me, and with a diameter of 1'4". And it's in three distinct sections. The base takes up about a fifth of the height, it's painted black, and like an iceberg, a good part of it's hidden below the surface of the road to make sure no one knocks the pillar box over and makes off with the mail. Mind you, the whole thing is made of cast iron, so they'd have a job. The maker's name is in relief, and I think I can just make out something that looks like Kedgewall Stephen & Co. Limited, London and Glasgow. But it's a bit battered down there, not to mention stained with a bit of dogwee, so it's hard to be sure. Next comes the main carcass, and that's painted this wonderful red. On the side that faces away from the road here, there's a door that runs the whole height of the carcass, and on it are some letters and a little crown sculpted in relief. The crown's about halfway up in the centre of the door. You'll be able to feel the rows of jewels, not really jewels, just metal jewels, on the arched top, the velvet inlay, and the two fleur-de-lis and gems studded around the base. Just to the right of the crown, you'll find the curved shape of the door handle. Here, the red paint's almost been worn away, right down to the black iron underneath it. And I think of all those postmen out in all weathers whose hands have touched that handle. It's amazing that they've actually eroded the paint. Below the crown is George V's cipher, and the letters GR standing for Georgius Rex. Here's a little interesting snip of information. George V is the only monarch who didn't have Roman numerals attached to his cipher. That was a cab that just went past, by the way. His dad, Edward VII, had a very flowery one, but George's letters are quite plain. Beneath this are the words Post Office in capitals. Above the crown, there's a rectangular enamelled plate which tells you when the last post will be collected. It says on a Saturday it's 12 noon. Sunday collections and deliveries are a thing of the past, of course. Like the rest of the pillar box, the frame surrounding the plate's a bit scruffy. The right-hand side has been broken off, and above the plate is the slot for the letters. Of course, it's horizontal, although early ones were sometimes vertical, and the whole thing is topped off by a gently domed cap to keep rain out of the slot. It's quite clever, actually. You wouldn't realise that that was part of the design, would you? It's decorated by 54 indentations around the edge, just big enough for a thumbprint. So, there you have it. Robust, ergonomic, authoritative, informative, and economical in design. It's had decades of continued use. You can feel all the bashes and notches it's acquired over the years. It's almost become what historians call a palimpsest, something that's had the present layered over layers of the past. And I was reminded of this when I first took my granddaughter out after she started to walk. I took her down to Formosa Street and I watched her observing all the tiny human interactions. You can hear a bloke with a little drill right now, can't you? There were scaffolders shouting to each other, dog walkers out for strolls. Our street shimmers with activity practically any time of day or night. And as we reached the pillar box, joy, oh joy, the postman arrived in his red van to empty it. And to her, he was Postman Pat. Look, I'm convinced I'm not barking mad to consider my pillar box as a symbol of our progress. When the penny post arrived in 1840, ordinary men and women were able to communicate outside their own village for the first time. It led to an explosion of celebration. The first Christmas card, birthday card, Valentine's card. I mentioned earlier that there's no Sunday service now. Well, at the beginning of the penny post, there were four or five deliveries a day. You could send a letter at noon and get a response by tea time. And after that, why not abroad too? By the beginning of the 20th century, there was a one penny post to the whole of the British Empire and to the USA, despite the naysayers' misgivings, because if you kept the price down, you achieved bulk sales. Recently, my pillar box was tagged by graffiti, and my first reaction was to feel hurt and upset by this horrific invasion of my history and aesthetics. And I think it was because this little pillar box really does signify home to me. Other people might choose a mountain or a lake, but for me, it's this little red column standing at the corner of Formosa Street and Warrington Crescent. And you know, I suppose that graffiti tag is just the latest layer of history.
More music now, and here's the full-length version of Piano Swing Blues by Goffby. Now, as I mentioned at the beginning, here, from TNF Soundings, is a list of audio-described programmes available on television, courtesy of the Otlian District Talking Newspaper.
TNF Soundings. Features from across the UK.
Hello to you all. This is John, selecting and reading my choice of audio-described television programmes for the week commencing Saturday the 7th of May and ending on Friday the 13th of May 2022. I hope you will find them helpful. So starting with Saturday the 7th, part 5 of Ainsley's Good Mood Food is on ITV at 11:35am with recipes featuring pulses and grains. BBC One is showing Bargain Hunt at 1:15pm. Today they're in Edinburgh. There's a musical fantasy film, Into the Woods, on BBC Two at 2pm. A wicked witch agrees to lift a curse on a young couple if they help to restore her once beautiful looks. At 7pm on ITV there's Romeo and Duet, a dating show where singletons are serenaded by singers, form into couples and then compete for a second date. At 7:15, Channel 4 is visiting the Lake District Farm Shop. Today the T-Bay baristas go on a training day. Also on 4, but at 8:15pm, Devon and Cornwall, Greener Lives, featuring residents who are determined to protect and preserve the environment. Then back to BBC One at 8:50 for Casualty, and David tries to get Ollie back on side. On to Sunday the 8th of May, there are more Homes Under the Hammer on BBC One at 11:15am, and this is followed still on 1 with Bargain Hunt at 12:15. ITV has another Midsummer Murder at 1:15pm. In The Flying Club, Barnaby and Nelson discover some dark secrets when the owner of an airfield is hit on the head and then dropped to his death from a plane. You can escape to the Chateau on Channel 4 at 7pm. Angel plans to redevelop the roof space of the Chateau into a bar from where they can watch the stars. ITV has part 4 of Grace at 8pm. In Dead Man's Footsteps, Grace investigates a skeleton which is found in a storm drain. Back to Channel 4 at 8 for Inside the Superbrands. Helen Skelton uncovers the secrets of the UK's best-selling bakery brand. Part 5 of Gentleman Jack is on BBC One at 9. Anne throws herself into the election of January 1835. Or you could watch Who Dares Wins on Channel 4 at 9. The recruits must pull a 1,000-kilogram vehicle from the sand whilst under indirect simulated fire. Or another choice at 9, but on BBC Two, is Idris Elba's Fight School. Idris needs to see a massive improvement across his entire squad. Now look at programmes on at the same time each weekday. And all the following daytime programmes are on BBC One. Homes Under the Hammer at 11:15am, but not on Tuesday as it's the state opening of Parliament. Bargain Hunt at 12:15. Doctors at 1:45, but not on Friday. Five Bedrooms at 2:15pm all week until the final episode on Wednesday. At 3pm you can escape to the country. Then on BBC Two, My Unique B&B can be seen at 6:30pm. All the soaps are running in their usual time slots and they are all audio described. Now looking at programmes on Monday the 9th of May. Channel 4 has Food Unwrapped at 8pm. In this, the first of a new series of three, Matt Tebbutt travels to Uruguay to investigate corned beef. At 9 o'clock, there's another new programme on Channel 4, The Spy Who Died Twice, a documentary about the MP John Stonehouse, who in the 1970s faked his own death and was then charged with fraud when he was found alive. Also at 9, but on BBC One, is the last ever episode of The Split. With Kate and Nathan's relationship on the rocks, Hannah makes a decision which shapes everyone's future. Did you watch part 1 of Married to a Psychopath? Well, the second and final part is on Channel 4 at 10 tonight, following the covert investigations into Malcolm Webster in the light of evidence that he tried to kill his second wife in similar circumstances to his first wife's death. Now on to Tuesday the 10th of May, three choices at 8pm. Martin Clune's Islands of Australia is on ITV. Martin swims with a whale shark. Or The Great Celebrity Bake Off Stand Up for Cancer is on Channel 4. Celebrities prepare eclairs and puff pastry. Or on Channel 5, The Yorkshire Vet. A lamb with a swollen leg, a greyhound with a badly broken leg, and an alpaca with a swollen lip are seen by the team tonight. Derry Girls continues on Channel 4 at 9. It's the Class of 1977 school reunion. BBC Two has the last part of Life After Life at 9 p.m. Ursula grapples with life and death during the Blitz. There's a one-off documentary on Channel 4 at 10 tonight. Will Young, Losing My Twin. Will talks about losing his twin brother to alcoholism and its effects it can have on the family. On to Wednesday, 11th of May. So let's start with some food. In Nadia's Time to Eat, Nadia shares dishes for when people are in a rush. Channel 4 has The Great Home Transformation at 8 p.m. This is the last in the property makeover series. Emma Willis and Nick Grimshaw help a young mother of two transform a house that has barely been touched since the family moved in. Staying with Channel 4, and Grand Designs is on at 9 p.m. Kevin MacLeod visits an army couple who have designed their own contemporary timber-clad house to where they can escape the bland beige of the barracks. The World's Most Extreme is on Channel 4 at 11.05 tonight and looks at the 10 most dangerous roads on the planet. Thursday the 12th of May, the Jubilee Pudding is on BBC One at 8 p.m. Five exceptional home bakers are selected to find a brand new pudding to mark the Queen's Platinum Jubilee. Over on Channel 4 at 8 p.m, Secret Spenders beat the price rises. Anita Rani helps families battle the cost of living by tackling the problems of overspending at the supermarket and their enjoyment of takeaways. On BBC Two at 9, The Art That Made Us examines how artists responded to the decisive shift of power from the countryside to the city during the 19th century. Or could you watch The Taskmaster on Channel 4 at 9? The teams face more perplexing tasks and become baffled by things as apparently simple as a high five and a fish tank. Part 5 of Chivalry is also on Channel 4, but at 10, Bobby and Cameron attempt to break away from work on the movie. If you want some reality, Ambulance Code Red is on Channel 5 at 10. In the two incidents tonight, a 21-year-old motorcyclist is thrown headfirst from his bike and an 80-year-old man has a cardiac arrest in his driveway. Finally, to Friday the 13th of May, in Our Lives on BBC One at 7.30 p.m, Speed Kids looks at children who dream of becoming the next generation of motorcycle racing stars. Unreported World on Channel 4 at 7.30 p.m. looks at female crime fighters and the work of Pakistan's first gender protection unit. Staying with Channel 4, and Richard Hammond's Crazy Contraptions is on at 8 p.m. Three amateur pilots are challenged to build a machine which will allow Richard to feed his dog without leaving his desk. Gogglebox is on Channel 4 at 9. The armchair critics share their opinions on programmes they have watched during the week. Moving to BBC Two at 9 and 9.40, The Terror Infamy, a horror drama anthology series. In part 3, the Terminal Islanders adjust to their new surroundings. And then in part 4 at 9.40, The Weak Are Meat. Alternatively, there's comedy on BBC One at 9.30. In the other one, Kat reignites a feud with a rival delivery driver, while Kathy's frustration ends up in humiliation. How about a new two-part series to end the week? Let's Make a Love Scene is on Channel 4 at 10 p.m. In this social experiment, four looking-for-love singletons appear in their own romantic comedy, coached through the series by an intimacy consultant who is acting as their coach. Part 2 is this time next week. I hope you find something of interest in my selection this week.
TNF Soundings.
I do hope you enjoyed the New York vocalized description of the new Yankee Stadium. This time, James Molinaro, the Staten Island Borough President, describes the 9/11 memorial on Staten Island.
Hello, I'm James Molinaro, president of the Borough of Staten Island. The 9/11 terrorist attack on the World Trade Center hit Staten Island especially hard. 275 Staten Island residents died when the towers went down. I felt that Staten Island needed its own memorial, a place for the loved ones of the victims to mourn and reflect, and a place for all visitors to remember those who lost their lives in that tragic day. I commissioned the artist and architect Masuki Sono to create a fitting memorial. The result is a sculpture called Postcards, and I'm happy to describe it for you. It's located on the north shore of the island, a short walk from the Staten Island Ferry Terminal. In fact, you can see the memorial from the ferry as it approaches Staten Island from Manhattan. In essence, postcards consist of two walls that face each other like two postcards standing on their ends. They are white and constructed of a fiberglass material. They are 40 feet tall and stand about 8 feet apart. You can say the twin postcards imitate the twin towers of the Trade Center, but they don't stand tall and straight like the towers. Instead, the artist has softly bent the upper edges of the walls outward, transforming simple rectangulars into an abstract form. Some people think they look like two curving wings forming a gentle V. Other people think of sails or flower petals. And still others think they look like pages of a book turning to a new chapter of life. The architect says he chose the design so that the visitors can interpret the walls in ways that they feel best for them. To get a better sense of their design, imagine you have two postcards on a table in front of you. You hold them vertically with your hands on top edges of the cards. Stand the bottom edges on the table a few inches apart so that they face each other. Angle them out a bit so that the corners closest to you are closer together. Now, keeping the bottoms of the cards on the table, lean the tops of the cards away from each other a bit and bend the tops of the cards out and away from each other so that there's a slight curve in the cards. Those shapes, in essence, are the sculpture's postcards. Sono chose this design because he felt that even in the high-tech era of cell phones and email, the postcard continues to be a personal handwritten communication sent across great distance. Sono liked that postcards are a simple way to send messages of love and remembrance. The two white walls are positioned on the St. George Esplanade, a wide open plaza that's paved with red bricks. If you stand between the walls and face north, you are looking directly across the harbor at Lower Manhattan and the spot where the Twin Towers stood. But the two walls are not solid slabs. To preserve individual memories of the people who died, Sonra designed six rows of rectangular boxes into the two walls that face each other. Each rectangle is 9 by 11 inches, about the size of a sheet of photocopy paper. Each rectangle contains a profile of the face of a person who died in the terrorist attack September 11, 2001, along with the person's name, birth date, and where the person worked. There are 263 profiles on the memorial, and as the sun strikes each profile, it casts the shadow of the profile behind it into a recessed box. At night, spotlights at the base of the wall substitute for the sun. So both day and night, lights and shadows bring the memorial and its profiles to life. If you visit the memorial, feel free to touch the profiles of the people. I am extremely proud that Staten Island has such a beautiful and moving tribute to the victims of 9/11. Our children and grandchildren will be able to come and look at it and think about the heroism and tragic loss of life on that awful day. I encourage you to visit the memorial on your next trip to Staten Island.
Now, in concert, an item new to Primary. David Ireson tells Jill Burridge about the musical performances in the local area upcoming in the next few weeks.
Hello again, it's Jill Burridge here. And to look at the music prospects for the coming month, I'm joined by David Arson again.
Hello.
Which is very nice. So we're looking at sort of mid-May through to mid-June, really, aren't we?
Yeah. Unusually, on the first weekend of May this year, there doesn't appear to be a concert on in St Albans or Harpenden, and regular listeners will know that this is indeed a rarity. However, the rest of the month certainly makes up for it, with choral concerts of both secular and sacred music and orchestral music for all ages and tastes.
Jolly good. So we'll head for the middle of the month then, and Saturday the 14th of May at the Cathedral in St Albans, the St Albans Symphony Orchestra performing a concert called Colours of France?
Yes. Combines voices, orchestra and organ in some lovely music. Debussy's Nocturnes, which has three movements, Nuages, Clouds, Fête, Festivals and Sirènes, Sirens. And for this, the orchestra will be joined in the third movement, the Sirens movement, by Gloriana, who will provide the wordless chorus of female voices. Debussy finished the work in 1899 and wrote that, "I am more and more convinced that music, by its very nature, is something that cannot be cast into a traditional and fixed form. It is made up of colours and rhythms." So it can thus be described as impressionistic and is typical of Debussy's orchestral music, full of colour and poetical painting. Gloriana will also sing Poulenc's Ave Verum Corpus, written for women's voices, and Fauré's ever-popular Cantique de Jean Racine. The soprano Jessica Gale will sing some of the Chants d'Averne by Joseph Canteloup. And for an orchestral concert, this one provides great variety, as the symphony at the end of the concert is Saint-Saëns' third symphony, which has a major organ part. A version of the organ symphony, as it is known, was used for the soundtrack of the film Babe. Where would filmmakers be without classical music? The combination
they did alter it a bit, didn't they?
They did a bit, yes. The organ will be played on this occasion by Andrew Parnell, who, of course, knows the cathedral organ well, having been assistant master of the music in the cathedral and was also conductor of the symphony orchestra from 1983 to 2001. A concert, as its title suggests, full of French colour and flavour. So to give you a glimpse into this musical world, here is one of the songs of the Auvergne, Bailero, the Shepherd's Song. You might have heard the folk song tune used by William Walton in his score for Laurence Olivier's film of Henry V, and also it was used in a Dubonnet advertisement. So here's one of the songs of the Auvergne.
An extract from one of the songs of the Auvergne called Bailero.
Yeah.
Absolutely lovely piece. And what a nice mix that concert sounds.
It is, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yep.
So that's Saturday the 14th of May. It's a 7:30 start. Colours of France is the name of the concert, given by the St Albans Symphony Orchestra. And it starts at 7:30. So we then move to the next day. As you say, we've now got lots of concerts.
Yes, yes.
And we've got two venues for this time. So one is in the afternoon, which is the St Albans Chamber Opera Tea
concert. Yeah, they're both afternoon concerts.
Oh, really. Are they?
And I don't think you can get from one to the other, so you have to make
a choice. No, you can't. So you've got to choose. Okay,
yeah.
So the 2:30 start is in St Stephen's
It
Church.
Is. This is if you want something on a rather smaller scale than the big orchestral stuff. The soprano Catherine Lewis, a wonderful yum-yum in the Chamber Opera Company's recent production of The Mikado, is giving a recital in St Stephen's Church Hall at 3:00 with the pianist Louisa Lamb. Their programme is entitled My Favourite Things and will include songs and arias, both classical and popular. From opera and art songs to songs from the shows, there will be something for everyone, not to mention tea, biscuits and cakes served from 2:30. Now, on the same afternoon, in the Western Auditorium at Hatfield at 4:00, the de Havilland Philharmonic is presenting a programme called Russian Romantics and featuring two great composers, Tchaikovsky and Glazunov, whose rarely heard saxophone concerto will be played by Hugh Wiggin. Alexander Glazunov wrote the concerto for alto saxophone and string orchestra in 1934. It lasts for around 14 minutes and is played without a break.
The saxophone was invented by Adolf Sax in the early 1840s, and it was still new and unfamiliar in Glazunov's day. Glazunov was enthralled by the sound of the instrument, which he thought brought a new timbre to the musical world. A German saxophonist called Sigurd Rascher asked Glazunov to write a concerto for the instrument, and was so insistent that Glazunov described his writing as being under the influences of attacks rather than requests. The piece was premiered in Sweden and not played in Paris, where Glazunov lived, having left the Soviet Union in 1928, until after the composer's death in 1936. He loved conducting, Glazunov, but apparently was not very good at it. He conducted the premiere of Rachmaninoff's First Symphony, but owing to lack of rehearsal time and perhaps his own shortcomings as a conductor, the piece was a disaster and led Rachmaninoff into a 3-year depression. However, his reputation as a composer remained undimmed, and he takes his place among the pantheon of great Russian composers.
Lovely to have something for the saxophone as
indeed,
well.
Indeed.
As you said, unusual. That's quite rare, isn't it?
It is, indeed. Mm. And then Tchaikovsky, two very popular works, the fantasy overture Romeo and Juliet and his Fifth Symphony. The idea of the Romeo and Juliet music was suggested to him by Balakirev, who was a leading figure in Russian music in the 1850s. In 1869, when Tchaikovsky was 29, Balakirev told him to write this and even told him how it should start and planned it out. And he wondered really whose piece it was, really. Anyway, Tchaikovsky revised the piece several times, and the version which we now know and the version you'll hear dates from 1880. I've always thought it must be one of the most exciting pieces to conduct, as these excerpts might show. First, we have the big romantic tune. And then towards the end of the piece, we have the big fight music, which, as you can imagine, is very exciting to conduct.
That's really nice to hear, because so often now it's the Prokofiev.
Yes, the Romeo and Juliet
that we hear, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
Because of The Apprentice,
yes, of
which it is the theme tune for. Anyway, so those two concerts are both on Sunday, the 15th of May in the afternoon. The earlier one, Favourite Things, is on at St Stephen's Church, 2:30, and the St Albans Chamber Opera Tea Concert is what it is. And then later in the afternoon, 4:00, is the start of the Tchaikovsky Russian Romantics one with Glazunov and the saxophone. And that's performed by the de Havilland Philharmonic, and it's held in the Western Auditorium of the University of Hertfordshire over in Hatfield.
Yeah. Can I add a bit more about that concert? Because it also includes Tchaikovsky's Fifth Symphony, written in 1888, first performed in the Mariinsky Theatre in St Petersburg, with Tchaikovsky conducting. He himself didn't think the symphony a great success, but it has proved to be one of his most popular works. One of the most notable performances was by the Leningrad Radio Orchestra during the Siege of Leningrad in 1941. The city leaders had ordered the orchestra to continue their performances to keep spirits up, and it was broadcast live to London. As the second movement started, bombs could be heard falling, but the orchestra played on until the last notes. Now, this, of course, has a certain poignancy given the present situation in the Ukraine, but we must, of course, separate the present leadership and its atrocities from the great cultural history of a great country with a troubled past. It seems all the more tragic that such wonderful music should come from a country whose leader is acting in such a dreadful way. Anyway, let's remember the best things to come out of Russia. Here's the start of the first movement of Tchaikovsky's Fifth Symphony.
Now let's move on to the following weekend, which is Saturday, the 21st of May. The Amadeus Chamber Orchestra are performing in St Saviour's Church in St Albans. This is an evening concert. And what are they doing?
Well, they're playing with the flautist Jana Hünecke, and she will play the Andante for flute and orchestra by Mozart, and also the Poulenc Flute Sonata. And this was written for flute and piano, but I suspect they will be playing the orchestral version by Lennox Barclay, which was commissioned by James Galway in 1976. The concert starts with music by Dvorak, his Czech suite, and as you would expect from the title, the five movements use folk-like melodies and it's a very tuneful piece. The concert finishes with Beethoven's Second Symphony, written in 1801-1802, when he was in his early 30s. It's one of the last pieces from what's called his early period and was composed at Heiligenstadt and first performed the following year in Vienna. Beethoven was suffering from increasing deafness and was beginning to realise that it might be incurable. The unusual start of the last movement was described by the musicologist Robert Greenberg as a hiccup, belch or flatulence followed by a groan of pain.
Oh.
This strikes me as one of those instances where the critic's imagination has run away with them.
Yes.
Anyway, you can judge for yourself. Here is the opening of the last movement. Beethoven himself conducted the first performance, and the concert also included his third piano concerto, at which he himself was a soloist, and his oratorio, Christ on the Mount of Olives. I hope the seats were comfortable, as the audience certainly got their money's worth. Anyway, one of the unusual things Beethoven did in this symphony was to do away with a minuet, which was the usual third movement of a symphony up to this point, and have a scherzo instead. This is a lively and light-hearted movement, and this one has been likened to an Austrian thigh-slapping dance. So here's the start of the scherzo.
Descriptions.
Yeah.
Fight slapping dance. Right. So that's the 21st of May. The Amadeus Chamber Orchestra will perform at St Saviour's Church in St Albans, and it starts that concert at 7:30. And then we move to June the 11th. I guess the early bit of June is missed out because we should be overwhelmed with Diamond
Indeed.
Jubilee celebrations.
Yes, I think we will.
Or even Platinum Jubilee celebrations, yes. Actually. Right, so we move to the 11th of June, and the music makers of Harpenden are inviting you to come and sing at the High Street Methodist Church in Harpenden.
They are. They are going to perform the piece in October, and I think this is an attempt to try and get some more members of the choir, so you can come and have a sing. It's a lovely piece. And if you like them, then presumably you stay on and sing in the concert, which is in October.
Ah, right. So is that an all-day thing?
The times can be found on the website. I did try to find out and haven't yet succeeded. I assume it will be, or afternoon and evening.
Way to go, anyway.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
So that's if you fancy singing in the High Street Methodist Church in Harpenden, and it's the music makers of Harpenden that you need to look up on the website for more details. The same afternoon, you can hear the St Albans Chamber Choir at St Saviour's Church in St Albans. 2:00 start. So what will they be doing?
It's a concert of secular music. The programme will include Gershwin's I Got Rhythm, John Rutter's Birthday Madrigals, Copland's In the Beginning, Morton Lauridsen's Nocturnes, and Eric Whittaker's Leonardo Dreams of His Flying Machine. I particularly like this piece with its imaginative text by Charles Anthony Silvestri, which occasionally breaks into Italian. Leonardo, Leonardo, vieni a volare. Leonardo, Leonardo, come fly. It starts with the words, tormented by visions of flight and falling, and ends, Leonardo steels himself, takes one last breath, and leaps. And then follows the fast, last, wordless section, which sort of fades out and ends with just the sound of the wind.
Ooh, very atmospheric.
Yeah.
So that's the concert on Saturday, the 11th of June, at St Saviour's Church in St Albans. 2 o'clock start with the St Albans Chamber Choir performing. And then the following weekend, Saturday the 18th, this is, over to Harpenden again. The Harpenden Choral Society are performing in the High Street Methodist Church there in the evening at 7:30.
Yes. Mendelssohn's Lauda Zion and Rossini's Stabat Mater. It's funny, isn't it, how composers or even pieces seem to come up close to each other. Mendelssohn's Lauda Zion, Praise the Lord, will be followed later in the year by the Bach Choir in St Albans doing his oratorio St Paul in July. Lauda Zion is an extended composition which Mendelssohn was asked to write for the Feast of Corpus Christi. It's in 8 movements, scored for choir, soloists and orchestra, and was written around the same time as his oratorio Elijah. Rossini's Stabat Mater was one of the pieces he wrote long after he had given up on his operatic career. It was hugely successful, and apparently its success got up the nose of Richard Wagner, who complained that Rossini was a rubbish composer and whatever he wrote was ridiculously popular and that there was far too much religious music making far too much money for people. He was certainly correct that Rossini was still very popular, for at the first performance, 3 numbers had to be repeated and Rossini's name was shouted loudly and frequently. So no wonder it got up Wagner's nose.
Touch of jealousy there.
Yeah, I think so, yes.
So that's the concert on Saturday, June the 18th at 7:30 in the evening at the High Street Methodist Church in Harpenden, when the Harpenden Choral Society will be performing. The following day, the de Havilland Philharmonic are in action again with a family concert this time.
They are. One of the James Mayhew family concerts in the Western Auditorium again. It's called Once Upon a Time and includes many firm favourites. These are the sort of pieces that I'm sure we were played when we were children. Dukas' Sorcerer's Apprentice, Rimsky-Korsakov's The Flight of the Bumblebee, 2 movements from Scheherazade, The Sea and Sinbad's Ship, Grieg's In the Hall of the Mountain King from the Peer Gynt Suite, Sibelius's Swan of Tuonela and Rossini's William Tell Overture. A great opportunity to introduce children and families to the wonders of the orchestra with some great music. I'm sure you recognise the William Tell Overture. No wonder it was chosen as the music for many films. William Tell is for Switzerland rather like Robin Hood is for us, a legendary character who, of course, in the Swiss story, shoots the apple from the head of his son. I like the definition of an intellectual as someone who can listen to the William Tell Overture and not think of the Lone Ranger.
Don't qualify with for that. It will always be associated with the Lone Ranger. Yes. And unfortunately, The Flight of the Bumblebee was the first record that I can remember ever owning.
Really?
And of course, I played it to extinction, basically, and now I can't bear to hear it at all. Anyway, those are a lovely family concert favourites, which the de Havilland Philharmonic will be performing on Sunday, the 19th of June, in Hatfield at the Western Auditorium of the University. There are 2 performances of the same concert, 2 o'clock start and 4:30 p.m. So that's the lineup for May and June. As you say, lots to go to if you
so
choose. And lots in the afternoon, if you'd rather go out in the afternoon than the evening.
Yep.
So enjoy your music making. Thank you very much, David. And hopefully we will meet again next month to look ahead to more music.
Indeed.
Bye
Thank
for now.
You, Jill. Bye-bye.
Here are some notable events which have happened this week in the past. On the 8th of May 1945, VE Day was celebrated in both Great Britain and America to celebrate victory for the Allies against Nazi Germany. Cities in both nations, as well as formerly occupied cities in Western Europe, put out flags and banners, rejoicing in the defeat of the Nazi war machine during World War II. On the 9th of May 1671, the Irish adventurer Captain Thomas Blood was captured attempting to steal the crown jewels from the Tower of London. Disguised as a priest, Blood managed to convince the jewel housekeeper to hand over his pistols, allowing his 3 accomplices to emerge from the shadows and force their way into the jewel house. However, they were caught in the act when the keeper's son returned unexpectedly and raised the alarm. King Charles was so impressed by Blood's audacity that rather than punishing him, he made him a member of the court and granted him an annual pension. On the 10th of May 1994, Nelson Mandela was inaugurated as South Africa's first black president. In his inaugural address, Mandela, who spent 27 years of his life as a political prisoner of the South African government, declared that the time for healing wounds has come. 2 weeks earlier, more than 22 million South Africans had turned out to cast ballots in the country's first ever multiracial parliamentary elections. Mandela's African National Congress Party was elected by an overwhelming majority. On the 11th of May 1812, Spencer Percival became the first and as yet only British Prime Minister to be assassinated. He was shot by deranged businessman John Bellingham in the lobby of the House of Commons. Bellingham, who was inflamed by his failure to obtain government compensation for war debts incurred in Russia, gave himself up immediately. Deemed insane, he was executed 1 week later. On the 12th of May 1937, King George VI was crowned in Westminster Abbey. Born Albert Frederick Arthur George, he assumed the regal name George VI to emphasise continuity with his father and restore confidence in the monarchy following the abdication of his elder brother, Edward VIII. Edward's relationship with the divorced American socialite Wallis Simpson had led to a constitutional crisis in the United Kingdom, ultimately forcing him to relinquish the crown. Dubbed the Reluctant King, George's reign lasted until his death in February 1952, aged just 56. On the 13th of May in 1981, Pope John Paul II was shot and seriously wounded during his weekly general audience in Rome's St. Peter's Square. The motives of his assailant, Mehmet Ali Agca, remain unclear, with theories about the assassination attempt ranging from a protest against American and Russian imperialism to the act of being part of a conspiracy involving the Bulgarian intelligence services and the KGB. One thing that remains clear, however, is the compassion shown by the pontiff as he urged the Italian authorities to pardon Mehmet in the late 1990s. On the 14th of May 1796, Edward Jenner administered the world's first vaccination as a preventive treatment for smallpox. While still a medical student, Jenner had noticed that milkmaids who had contracted a disease called cowpox did not catch smallpox. Unlike the deadly smallpox, cowpox led to few ill symptoms in these women. Jenner tested his theory by infecting his test subject with a small amount of fluid from a cowpox blister. As this led to few ill effects, 2 months later he inoculated the boy with smallpox matter and no disease developed. Doctors all across Europe quickly adopted Jenner's innovative technique, leading to a drastic decline in new sufferers of the devastating disease. And now some famous birth dates. The 8th of May. Two famous football teammates share their birthdays on the 8th of May. Jack Charlton and Nobby Stiles played together in England's 1966 World Cup winning team. Born in 1935, Jack won 35 England caps, and as manager of the Republic of Ireland for 10 years, notably took them to 2 World Cups and a European Championship. Nobby, who was born in 1942, won 28 England caps. The film clip of him dancing on the pitch at the end of the World Cup final with a gap-toothed grin, the trophy in one hand and his false teeth in the other, is one of the most frequently shown images of that match. The 9th of May is the birth date of Leeds-born author and playwright Alan Bennett, now aged 88. The son of a co-op butcher, Bennett won a scholarship to Oxford University and was later an academic there, researching and teaching medieval history for several years, but during his time as an undergraduate he had performed with the Oxford Review. This led to the satirical review Beyond the Fringe, a collaboration with Jonathan Miller, Peter Cook and Dudley Moore. First staged at the Edinburgh Festival in 1960, and later in London's West End, and on New York's Broadway. An instant success, it led Bennett to become a full-time writer for the theatre and television. Among his many works are The Madness of George III and its film adaptation, the series of monologues Talking Heads, the play and subsequent film of The History Boys, and more recently, The Lady in the Van, a memoir telling the mostly true story of his interactions with Mary Shepherd, an elderly and eccentric woman who lived in a dilapidated van on his driveway in London for 15 years. The story was turned into a film starring Maggie Smith in 2015. The 10th of May. Frederick Austerlitz was born this day in 1899 in Omaha, Nebraska. But within a few short years, he would become Fred Astaire, the future star of stage and screen musicals. Astaire became a dancer and entertainer because his mother wanted him to escape life in the Midwest, and she achieved this by pairing six-year-old Fred and his older sister Adele in a child vaudeville act. They were very successful, eventually breaking into Broadway by the time Fred was 18, but their partnership ended in 1932 when Adele married the 9th Duke of Devonshire. Now on his own, Astaire attended a Hollywood screen test. Legend says the verdict was, "Can't sing, can't act, balding, can dance a little," though the exact wording is disputed. Despite this withering assessment, Astaire did make it as a film star. His most famous dance partnership was with Ginger Rogers, with whom he made 9 musical films between 1933 and 1939, including Flying Down to Rio, The Gay Divorcee, Top Hat, and Follow the Fleet. In them, Astaire not only danced and sang, but played the piano too. Over a lengthy career, Astaire took on serious non-dancing roles as well as musicals, appearing in Finnegan's Wake, Towering Inferno, and even an episode in the science fiction television series Battlestar Galactica. Among numerous awards, Astaire won several Emmys and Golden Globes, as well as a Grammy and an Academy Award. He was even awarded a life membership in the National Skateboard Society after taking up the pursuit in his late 70s. He died in 1987, aged 88. On the 11th of May, broadcaster, journalist and author Jeremy Paxman was born in 1950 in Leeds. After graduating from Cambridge, he joined the BBC in 1972, initially working in local radio. Later, he worked on the Tonight and Panorama programmes, before becoming a newsreader for the BBC 6 o'clock news. In 1989, he became a presenter for the BBC Two programme Newsnight, where he became known for his interviews with a wide range of political figures. His style was either abrasive, intimidating and rude, or tough and no-nonsense, depending on one's point of view. After 25 years, he left Newsnight, but continues to be seen on screen as the presenter of the revived University Challenge. The 12th of May is the birthday of comedian Tony Hancock. Born Anthony John Hancock in Birmingham on 1924, he was brought up in Bournemouth. His early career was on the stage, but he moved into radio, in programmes including Workers' Playtime and Educating Archie. In 1954, he was given his own show, Hancock's Half Hour, an early form of situation comedy which ran for 7 years and, from 1956, ran concurrently with an equally successful television series with the same name. Both featured Sid James as Hancock's stooge, though he was dropped for Hancock's final series in 1961, titled, simply, Hancock. Hancock was a highly strung, insecure character, prone to introspection. He was also a heavy drinker and eventually an alcoholic. He committed suicide with a combination of vodka and pills in Sydney, Australia, in 1968. 13th of May. English composer Sir Arthur Seymour Sullivan was born in 1842. He is known for his 14 operettas written in collaboration with the dramatist W.S. Gilbert, including HMS Pinafore, The Pirates of Penzance, and The Mikado. But Sullivan was much more than a composer of light comic music. He also produced numerous operas, orchestral and choral works, popular ballads and church pieces, including hymns such as Onward Christian Soldiers. His partnership with Gilbert was hugely successful. London's Savoy Theatre was built on the profits, but it came to an end after a row about money, ironically involving upkeep for the Savoy. Following the split, Sullivan worked with various collaborators and in 1899 wrote a song, The Absent-Minded Beggar, to a text by Rudyard Kipling, to benefit the dependents of men on active service in the Boer War. It was an instant hit and raised an astonishing £300,000, equivalent today to over £34 million. Sullivan had a long history of ill health, and a year later he died, aged 58. Against his own wishes, but by order of Queen Victoria, he was buried in St Paul's Cathedral. 14th of May. Eric Morecambe is one of Britain's best-loved comedians. Born in 1926, John Eric Bartholomew took his stage name from his hometown. He formed a comedy duo with Ernie Wise in 1941 after they met performing in a revue at the Nottingham Empire. After the war, they began appearing on television. Their shows often featured well-known stars who were mercilessly sent up by the pair, especially Eric, while newsreader Angela Rippon's appearance as a dancer in one show caused a sensation. Their BBC Christmas shows were among the most popular ever broadcast, and, over 50 years later, are still regularly shown as repeats. Eric Morecambe had suffered a heart attack in 1968, and again in 1979, which necessitated bypass surgery. In 1984, after taking 6 curtain calls on stage at Tewkesbury, he collapsed with a third heart attack and died the next day. And finally, for those of us for whom a really hot summer day is still one where the thermometer hits 90 degrees and not a mere 30, the 14th of May is the birthday of German physicist Daniel Fahrenheit, born in 1686. And that finishes up this edition of Primary. My thanks to Jane, Andy, David, Deborah, Christine, Jessica and Keith for reading the news, to Angela for providing the radio listings, and to John who read them. Thanks also to all at TNF Soundings, Tony Robinson and James Molinaro, and Wendy for the week in history and famous birthdays. Primary will be back after the Platinum Jubilee weekend. Let me take this opportunity to wish you a safe and enjoyable May. Please remember to return your USB stick and wallet after use, and please stay well and safe. Goodbye.